Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibe. This week on Culturetopia, a cellist who uses a computer to record sounds and musical phrases to create her own one-woman symphony. Alexandra Fuller's new memoir. The author of Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight paints a loving portrait of her hard-drinking mother, a white farmer in Africa. And Western opera stars explore Chinese traditions in hopes of finding work abroad. But first.
More than 20 years ago, the Libyan writer Hisham Mattar's father disappeared. His father was an opponent of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi and was in exile when he was kidnapped. He hasn't been seen since. Just as Gaddafi's regime was collapsing this summer, Hisham Mattar published a novel about an exile who's kidnapped. Anatomy of a Disappearance is told from the point of view of the victim's son.
All that I did not know about my father, his private life, his thoughts, why he was kidnapped and by whom, what he had actually done to provoke such actions, where he was at this moment, whether he could be counted among the living or the dead, was like a mask that suffocated me. I felt guilty, too, as I continue to feel today, at having lost him, at not knowing how to find him or take his place. Every day I let my father down.
Hisham Mattar reading from Anatomy of a Disappearance, his new novel. He's in our studios. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
The passage that you read is the memory of a young man who doesn't know where his father is now. And in fact, you choose to tell this story through a 14-year-old. He's 14 at the time of the kidnapping, which means he knows even less. He's not really sure what it was his father was doing that was making anybody angry. He's not really sure who kidnapped him, although it's believed that a Gaddafi-like government kidnapped him. Why tell the story that way?
I think ultimately, you know, one of the ways into contemporary Middle Eastern history is to use the construct of the father and son.
What do you mean?
The older generation, the generation of the father, were the audacious ones, the ones that were reckless politically and had these high dreams and didn't blush when they spoke about it. My generation were the generation that were restrained, the generation that was shy about speaking about these things.
You're saying your father's generation was the one that dreamed of modernizing and bringing ahead the Middle East and building a new world. And that younger people, people of your age, and how old are you, may I ask?
I'm 40.
People of your generation went along with the dictators who ended up in charge of these various countries for a long time.
Well, everybody went along, but I do sense, and I have sensed since I was very young, that I'm part of a generation that isn't as audacious as the generation before. A generation, and actually I think that lack of audacity is not such a bad thing. I think my generation's inability to speak in absolute terms when it comes to politics is a very positive thing. It's made us more nuanced, made us more complex. Now we see that the newer generation, the generation of the present revolutions, you know, one of the nicknames of the Libyan revolution is the revolution of the young men in falling jeans.
You know? So they are people 10 or 20 or even 25 years younger than you.
Exactly. Yeah. And that it seems like audacity had skipped a generation.
Now, what have you thought as you have watched the revolution specifically in your country? I think you told someone a few months ago you're consumed by this story.
It's a moment of dramatic transition. It's embedded in it also a great deal of uncertainty and anxiety. But what is certain is that people have glimpsed another possibility. They have just a very quick glimpse of what it might be to live in a just and dignified way. And that might take a long time to be realized, but I believe that once you see that, once a people see that, it's impossible to erase it.
When was the last time you were in Libya?
My family left Libya in 1979, so I haven't been to Libya in 32 years.
How vivid are your memories of your childhood in Libya?
Very vivid. You know, as a writer, I know that some of the most powerful memories are those when you are very, very young. After that, everything becomes, it's as if sort of seen through a reflection. You know, adult life is seen through the reflection of complex rational thought, you know. Yeah. Whereas when you're young, it's so immediate, and a lot of the sensations are for the first time. So it's very vivid, but it's also abstract. So there's always a question of, you know, why didn't you get over it? You know, if you were a sensible human being, you wouldn't be thinking about Libya anymore. But I'm not sensible. I'm deeply involved with Libya for many reasons. I think mostly because I'm in love with it, but also because my family history is so intertwined with the country.
So you left the country in 1979 because your father had disagreements with the regime, and you lived abroad in Cairo, if I'm not mistaken. Your father was picked up in 1990. What happened?
Well, after we left Libya, my father became a very vocal opponent to the Gaddafi regime. And we lived in Egypt, which was a safe place for people who were on the wrong side of the Libyan dictatorship, up to the late 80s, when they started to become friends, but also they realized that they could help each other.
The Mubarak dictatorship in Egypt and the Gaddafi dictatorship in Libya.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the things that they did was to hand over dissidents that were residing in each other's countries. So my father was a victim of that. He was kidnapped by the Egyptian secret services. And he effectively disappeared. We later found out that he was sent to Libya, where he was tortured and imprisoned, never subjected to a trial, so we don't even know what he's technically accused of. And the dictatorship continued until its end to deny this fact, and the Egyptian dictatorship also.
Could your father still be alive in Libya somewhere?
It's a possibility. You know, it's impossible to give up hope until you know, really. I recently went to a fishing village in Ireland. And it's the only place I went to where I found people that feel exactly the same way as I do about my father. There are several fishermen who had disappeared, you know, because they fish on their own on these tiny boats, very high sea. So I met this lady who's about my age. When she was 8 years old, her father went out to earn his keep, and he never returned. She can't entirely give up hope that he's somehow alive, you know. On some level, it seems a far clearer situation. Sea, man, never seen again. And it illustrates also how hope, living in hope, is a really terrible thing. I mean, people speak about hope most of the time as a very positive thing. And I understand why, and it's become sort of entered into political language and so on. But really, if you stop and think about the state of living in hope, it's a very dispossessing thing. It's a very difficult thing to live with. So when you've been living in hope for a long time, as I have, suddenly you realize that certainty is far more desirable than hope.
Hisham Mattar is the author of In the Country of Men and his new novel, Anatomy of a Disappearance. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Alexandra Fuller caught the world's attention with her first book, a best-selling memoir of growing up in Africa called Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. It looked back on 1970s Rhodesia, the country now known as Zimbabwe, when white farmers were fighting a war against black rebels. It was a harsh and even tragic life where her parents lived through the deaths of three of their five young children. In that first book, Fuller's mother came across as a charismatic but troubled woman who drank too much and had a casual approach to mothering. Perhaps not surprising, Nicola Fuller always called it the awful book. In her new memoir, Alexandra Fuller looked further back to her mother's young life, an idyllic childhood in colonial Kenya, which produced a beautiful young woman, a madcap adventuress with a predilection for drama. It's called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness.
First of all, as my mother said, we don't really have cocktail hour. We have cocktail days. And often stories would start with, well, there was rather a lot to drink, I seem to remember. And then this sort of tale of chaos and madness and hilarity ensues.
Alexandra Fuller says in writing this memoir, she discovered a mother she never knew, the person her mother saw herself to be, a character of high romance.
She, at some point, must have looked around and decided that all her literary heroines, Beryl Markham and Isaac Dinesen, had flown aeroplanes, and that this was something she did not have in her repertoire, and that therefore her biography was incomplete. So she signed herself up with this charlatan flying instructor and taught herself to fly.
As you describe it, as she's flying this little plane, you can hear in the radio back on the ground her singing.
She was singing, "Fly Me to the Moon."
You know, there's a moment that seems to sum up the funny side of her eccentricity, even though you are, as a child, often the victim of it. When you and your older sister, Vanessa, she dressed you up for a kids' costume party. Tell us about that.
So Mother's fancy dress parties were always hell, and she had endured these awful fancy dress parties as a child. I think it must be a peculiarly colonial form of entertainment to slap your kids up in these awful, hot, inappropriate, itchy costumes and, you know, make them parade around in the baking sun. And so having learned nothing from her childhood, my mother forced ever more killingly imaginative costumes on my sister and I. And the worst possible one was she decided to dress my older sister Vanessa up as a rose. And then she dressed me up as, quote, "I never promised you a rose garden," in an insecticide drum.
Right. Now, wait, your sister is in a tutu, pink little ribbons, very pretty, very girly thing. And you're in a...
I'm in an insecticide drum, yeah.
And a drum that had insecticide still in it a bit, I mean, on the inside, right?
Right, it was that incredibly toxic insecticide that you dust young tobacco seedlings with.
Why don't you read a little bit about that moment?
Mum explained that when she was in labor with me in England, the radio was playing "I Never Promised You a Rose Garden," which was prophetic because when I arrived, I really was, as promised, not a rose garden. Mum has refused to waver from the story, even though I've since discovered the song became a hit a full year and a half after I was born and therefore could not have been playing when she was in labor with me. She had yellow skin and black hair. That's why we call her Bobo, Mum explained, because she looked just like a little baboon.
And your mother just proceeded apace.
Yes.
She didn't apologize. I mean, she didn't say, "Oh, sorry, dear, I didn't want to hurt your feelings." Right?
You know, I think that one of the things about being raised British in Africa was you got this double whammy of toughness, because the sort of continent and place itself made you quite tough. And then you've got this British mother whose entire being rejects, quote-unquote, coddling in case it makes you too soft. So there's absolutely nothing standing between you and a fairly rough experience.
Well, your book does tell a tale of a sometimes quite dangerous and cruel world that you inhabited as a child. And part of that time was in a country at war, a war of liberation, rebels in Rhodesia trying to bring about a majority or black rule. But your mother and father were part of a colonial layer who felt they belonged there.
Correct.
Give us an example of what that really meant.
By the time the war was getting towards the end in the late 1970s, there were landmines frequently on the roads near where our farm was. The attacks on farmers were ratcheting up. So my parents didn't want us being on the roads unnecessarily because of ambushes and landmines. And I hadn't understood that that was the reasoning behind leaving my younger sister and I with a neighbor one fateful January morning when I was left to keep an eye on my little sister and she drowned. And this was just so heartbreaking. Dad had said, "It wasn't that your mother didn't want to protect you, it's just there was so much to protect you from." It just hadn't occurred to her that somebody could drown in a duck pond. And I think that is one of the things about war, is that the common or garden accidents that you have the luxury to look out for when you're not literally under the gun, those seep away from your attention.
We do, in the book, end up back at the tree of forgetfulness, the banana and fish farm that your parents now live on and presumably will live out their days. There's a passage I'd like you to read that really gets to the beauty of Africa and how they see Africa.
"The evenings out here on the north bank of the Zambezi River are tremulously beautiful. A shaky ribbon of blue smoke from a nearby village's cooking fire hangs over the farm. Emerald-spotted doves are calling, 'My mother is dead, my father is dead, my relatives are dead,' and my heart goes dum, dum, dum. Frogs are bellowing from the causeway, the air boils with beetles and cicadas, mosquitoes and tsetse flies. Egrets, white against the grey-pink sky, are floating upriver to roost in the winterthorn trees in the middle of Dad's bananas. 'I won't let him chop down those trees,' Mum says. 'The birds love them.'"
That's Alexandra Fuller reading from her new memoir, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. You can hear how her charming mother responded to this book and the first memoir at our website, npr.org. This week, tennis fans are watching the closing rounds of the U.S. Open tournament, and we're about to hear from a queen of the court for our occasional series, In Your Ear. That's where we listen to songs that have inspired some of our program's favorite guests. Today, we're hearing from Zina Garrison. At the end of 1989, Garrison rose to her top ranking ever, number 4 in the world. And in 1990, she became the first black woman to reach the Wimbledon finals since Althea Gibson in the 1950s. After leaving the game, Garrison became an ace in the arena of public service, creating her own foundation to bring tennis to inner-city kids, and at one point serving on the President's Council on Physical Fitness and Sports. Now, we'll hear what songs keep her spirit in winning shape, on the court and off.
Hi, I'm Zina Garrison, and the music that's in my ear now is John Legend, and one of my favorite songs is Wake Up with the band Roots.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There is so much hatred, war and poverty.
It just really gets me in a very inspirational mood, and it just gets me to want to wake up in the morning. And another artist who I extremely love is Chrisette Michele, and I'm Gonna Be Okay.
I'm gonna take my Lexus to the mall, get a little black dress just because. Me and my boo just broke it off. I'm gonna be fly although he's gone. I don't really care about who he's with. I'm gonna get mine and he'll get his. Even though I was in love with him, I really hope the best for them.
Love that song, because sometimes you just have a moment where you just need to tell yourself that I'm gonna be okay no matter what it takes. Another song I love is by Yolanda Adams, I Got the Victory. Oh, wow. Because I feel like each and every moment that I wake up, that is definitely a victory to start a new day with a positive attitude on life.
That was former American tennis star Zina Garrison telling us what's playing in her ear. If you want to hear the full conversation with Zina Garrison, please go to the program page of NPR.org and select Tell Me More.
And now, the story of a classical cellist whose paralyzing stage fright did not shut down her career. Instead, it helped make her a success. Zoe Keating's self-released recordings have gone to the top of the iTunes classical charts, and she's even gone back to performing on stage. From member station KALW in San Francisco, Martina Castro visited Keating at home and sent this profile.
Zoe Keating's latest album is called Into the Trees, and that's exactly where I have to go to meet her. She lives in the middle of a redwood forest, an hour and a half north of San Francisco. As Keating walks me around, we listen for her noisy neighbors, the woodpeckers.
And they get really loud again in the evening. And they sound like, they're like...
It's fitting to find Keating in the middle of all this natural noise, because in her studio, she creates a similar symphony of sounds, except she does it with just one instrument, her cello. Her secret is in how she constructs her songs. Keating uses computer software to record sounds and musical phrases as she plays them on her one instrument. When she plays something she wants to keep, she taps on a series of pedals at her feet. Those pedals tell the computer program to save and loop what she just played. That frees her up to play a new musical phrase, along with what she just recorded. She can then record and loop that combination, which frees her up to play something else, then something else, until she's created layers upon layers of sound that all came from her one cello. And all of this is communicated to the computer program through the pedals she taps with her feet.
Like, I'll spend 8 hours, you know, I'm just recording parts and I'm in the groove and I'm just adding layers and layers and layers and layers. It gets bigger and bigger and then it goes in new directions. And then I clean it up later. So it's almost like there's two parts to it. There's the kind of like getting it all down and then the cleanup and the refining.
And the getting all down, that's an improvisational thing. Yeah. It's just you jamming with yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Totally. I'm jamming with myself. It's like me down here having a party with like 16 other cellos.
Keating didn't always play this style of music. She started playing the cello classically when she was 8. But when she reached her teens, something weird started happening during her performances.
Suddenly I'm like, how am I doing this? This seems really difficult. How am I doing it? And then soon enough, you wouldn't be able to play the cello. And I would like falter. You know, your fingers would make it screw up. Or your bow, you do a wrong thing. Like, your brain works against you.
This turned into paralyzing stage fright that led Keating to give up pursuing a classical career. But in college, she continued to play.
So I started improvising, and I found that when I improvised, I wasn't nervous.
She started experimenting with her instrument, especially when she discovered electronic music in San Francisco.
And I thought, wouldn't it be neat to make music that has that same production quality, but entirely acoustic?
Keating says she's still discovering new sounds she can make with her cello.
I was really interested in the things that were kind of not musical, little screeches and...
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, can I do it? Can you hear it if I do? Mm-hmm. Sort of just a ponticello is a good one. You know, like when... Here's a regular cello sound. And then if you move the bow up a little bit... How that's different?
Yes.
So there's a lot of potential in there.
This experimentation led Keating to realize what was really paralyzing her all along.
It's like perfection was the thing that was destroying me and being totally focused on making it perfect.
Now on stage, it's not about being perfect.
Like, I make a lot of mistakes.
And they just become part of the song.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel it's almost become this sort of thing where... Yeah, if I make a mistake, I have to work with it.
But the thing is, you would never know it. When I ask her to improvise something, she closes her eyes and without a second thought, begins to play. Slowly, each note comes out as if it were born organically from her instrument. What could be a mistake is easily transformed into a new direction, a new sound, a new expression. And then, it's hard to imagine it sounding any other way. For NPR News, I'm Martina Castro in San Francisco.
Our program is directed by Jonathan Baer, edited by Corey Turner and Allison McAdam, and produced by Matt Martinez. The technical director is Stu Rushfield. The engineering supervisor is Robert Jackson.
At the science desk, Ann Gudenkoff, Allison Richards, Joe Neal, April Fulton, Vicki Valentine, Rebecca Davis, Jessica Goldstein, and Jane Greenhalgh. All Things Considered's executive producer is Christopher Turpin. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We're going to spend the rest of this hour with a group of American opera singers working well outside their comfort zone. They've just spent a month in Beijing learning to sing modern Chinese opera. The I Sing Beijing program was funded by the Chinese government, but as NPR's Louisa Lim reports from Beijing, one man with a remarkable life story made it happen.
Lesson number one, saying thank you in Chinese. For American soprano Maria McDaniel, this is the start of a linguistic journey into another culture. She's one of 20 American and European singers who recently spent a month in Beijing learning to sing modern Chinese operas.
There are no lips.
Oh, right, and it's very frontal.
Her days are packed with language lessons and one-on-one workshops. McDaniel says she's keen to explore China as a possible market of the future, given the dwindling opportunities for opera singers at home.
Many prominent opera companies have closed their doors. Much more have had to cut down on their seasons, the number of productions, and then the number of jobs are shrinking. So that was another reason that fueled my interest in coming over here and exploring.
She's learning to sing a role from a modern Chinese opera called Chinese Orphan. At the end of the month, each of the singers will perform an aria. They'll sing at the most prestigious venue in China, Beijing's National Center for the Performing Arts.
This is a very special day for me.
This is the brainchild of Hao Jiangtian, a Chinese opera singer who's made it on the international stage. Once a factory worker, he arrived in the U.S. penniless, knowing just three words of English. Within a decade, he was performing at the Met. He hopes this program will reduce the kind of discrimination he faced when he tried to break into opera in the West.
I had some terrible experiences with the directors, conductors, and the managers too, and because still, this is a Western opera, Western culture. The first rehearsal, if I don't know this conductor, director, my singing colleagues, and I could see lots of question marks in their eyes. This is Chinese. Can he sing?
Yet new contemporary Chinese music is having a bigger impact in the West. And Tian has premiered in a clutch of high-profile pieces, including The First Emperor of the Met, written by composer Tan Dun. Tian points out that China's economic boom is also creating a cultural boom.
Everybody knows the economy is really growing fast, so there are lots of money here and there, and so every city wants to become an international city, so they build an opera house. Government really put in lots of money for cultural events and developments.
With his program, Tian has come back to where he started. He takes the singers and a documentary crew to visit a Beijing boiler factory where he spent 6 years working on a steel cutting machine. As the cameras roll, together with his old colleagues, he belts out a forbidden American folk song, which back then they used to sing secretly. The most moving moment comes when a group of young factory workers start singing their factory anthem. This turns out to be Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. The new lyrics include a mention of how the company is burning its chest to warm the earth. The opera singers join in, their polished chorus providing the perfect counterpoint to the workers. At this moment, the two halves of Tian's life have come together. Maria McDaniel voices the mood.
This is only his second time returning here in 40 years. Can you imagine? It's a celebration of every kind. When I walked in, I felt so emotional because it was like to share a part of his journey like this, to celebrate how far he's come, I think is remarkable.
Tian has managed to secure Chinese government funding for I Sing Beijing, even though many of the big names involved are volunteering for free. True to its name, the official launch of I Sing Beijing is punctuated with outbreaks of song. This one welcomes guests from afar. The program's major funder was the Hanban, which is better known for setting up Confucius Institutes to teach Chinese language outside China. Asked about its soft power ambitions, the Institute's executive director, Xu Lin, said this.
Chinese people are now seen as rich country bumpkins without taste or culture. I'm trying to let the outside world know that China's 5,000 continuous years of culture is very attractive.
When it comes to understanding Chinese culture, tenor Thomas Glenn has one of the steepest learning curves. He's been assigned a much-loved Peking opera piece, The Siege of Tiger Mountain. But his first impressions of Peking opera weren't all that positive.
From our point of view and where our Western ears, it seems a very shrill, very monochromatic art form.
But by the time of the gala performance, he's had a month of masterclasses with a Peking opera star, Jiang Qihu. The audience is hugely appreciative. And Glenn says he's learnt a new respect for the art form.
To realise that these Peking opera singers study their whole lives to learn not only how to sing, but to dance, to do kung fu and their own makeup is very impressive. I can't say that I would ever become a Peking opera singer because it's very difficult to sing that type of music, but I certainly have a great respect for it.
On the big night, Maria McDaniel sings her aria from Chinese Orphan. By then, Hao Jiangtian is already looking ahead. And he has an inkling that that opera may be part of his next big project.
My dream is that someday I could help to cast a whole Western cast to sing a Chinese contemporary opera. Maybe next year.
So the first day of your program, when you said my dream has come true.
Yes.
In fact, now 10 days later, your dream has already changed and become bigger and different.
Dream, that's the beauty of a dream, is because every night could be different.
One man's dream of promoting intercultural understanding is overlapping with a larger official dream of showcasing modern China's cultural strengths. At the gala concert, the success of the I Sing Beijing program is clear, and nowhere more so than during the finale. A heartfelt rendition by the chorus of Westerners of one of China's most famous songs. Its name, I Love You, China. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Beijing.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katzer and executive produced by Sarah Saracen. I am Neda Ulubu. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.